America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Some believe that a good part of the Donald Trump push toward the White House in 2016 was fueled by the push of jobs offshore. He had been talking about the issue of bad trade deals since the 1980s. Then the victor was Japan, not China. The question remains, how hard is America working to reclaim its role as a manufacturing giant? And are the concerns exposed by supply chain interruptions bringing more urgency to this issue? A man who's dedicating his entire life to reshoring is with us today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Harry Moser, and he's the president of Reshoring Initiative. And Harry, to begin our conversation about manufacturing in America and bringing back the supply here to the United States and making it ourselves, you started this whole effort about 10 years ago. What prompted you at that time, and what has changed over the 10 years?
The emotional motivation to do it. I grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, right across the river from New York City. And the biggest thing in town, in fact, the biggest factory in the world, was the Singer sewing machine plant there. 2.5 million square feet, 5,000 workers. My grandfather was a foreman. My dad ran a third of it. I worked there summers. And I drove past 20 years ago, and it's all gone. As far as I can tell, everything that Singer sells is purchased, is imported from offshore. And during my career, I sold high-end machine tools and foundry equipment, and industry after industry, company after company I wanted to sell to went out of business before I got to sell them anything. So I said, this isn't good for the country. It's not the right direction. So when I retired from running businesses, I founded the Reshoring Initiative.
And how do you feel about the direction we're going in? You got my attention because you put something out, and I get all of your correspondence saying reshoring is poised to surge 38% to a record high. That might surprise people. What does the pandemic have to do with this?
At first, I'll give you the data to support your statement. When we started it in 2010, the total number of jobs announced that year was about 6,000 jobs. In 2017, it peaked at 180,000 jobs announced in the year. Due to the tax and regulatory cuts, fell off for 2 years due to the trade war, business uncertainty, and then picked up last year due to COVID. The country realized that we had severe shortages of PPE, penicillin, all kinds of stuff. So things started to get in gear, and then this year it spread to other industries, especially the president. President Biden has targeted key industries where we need to reshore: chips and the EV batteries and rare earth minerals and things like that. So there's been tens of billions of dollars investment announced, collectively bringing in tens of thousands of jobs. So we're having a surge this year up to somewhere between 200 and 220,000 manufacturing jobs announced. So I'm delighted with the strength of the reshoring, but I'm still disappointed with the size of the trade deficit. This year we'll have a record trade deficit somewhere close to $1 trillion, which represents about 5 million manufacturing jobs that would be here if we did not have that trade deficit. So we've made excellent progress, but we've got a hell of a long way to go.
How do you define reshoring? because it's so complicated. I see where products are assembled in the U.S., they're designed, created here, parts come from here, and then we send them to Mexico to put them together. I mean, it's just such a confusing mix for most of us.
Yeah. So for reshoring is performing a process here in manufacturing, not generally not design, not marketing, not finance, but in manufacturing. So performing work in manufacturing that previously was done or would have been done offshore. So if you bring back if there's a car being assembled in Mexico or China now and shipped here, and then you start to assemble it here, well, you've reshored the assembly. And if all the parts still came from China, well, you haven't reshored the parts. If you start to source some of those parts here in the U.S., then you've reshored some of the supply chain to support the assembly. We track a combination of reshoring by U.S. companies, think General Motors, for example, but also FDI, foreign direct investment by foreign companies, think Siemens or Toyota.
How prevalent is that? I know I had done a podcast a while back, and there seemed to be a lot of activity as it relates to that foreign direct investment in the U.S. Is that because the customer base here is so strong? I mean, we say today that rather than being a manufacturing economy, we're really a consumer-driven economy.
No question. Of course, eventually to be consumers, you have to have income. And if you're going to have income, somebody's got to make something somewhere. And so it's a strong the FDI has, over the 10 years that we've tracked it, the FDI on average had been higher than the reshoring. There were more jobs coming in by the foreign companies than by the domestic companies. But now in the last 2 years, the reshoring has been stronger, and I think it's because of COVID that foreign companies can't easily come over here to look at sites and to make deals and do whatever, and companies have gone back to, let's say, to protect the motherland, to the U.S. companies feel more obligation to do things here in the U.S., and the German companies feel more obligation to do things in Germany, because that's their culture, that's their homeland.
You say that there are many reasons for American manufacturers to reevaluate offshoring. The supply chain problems that we are seeing today, now again, they're exacerbated by what happened during the pandemic, but is that the key reason? Obviously, we'd love to have these jobs back here for a multitude of reasons, but from a manufacturer's standpoint, because many of them, U.S. companies, they decided initially to go offshore.
And they went offshore, some of them for very good reasons, because 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the Chinese labor cost was 10% of ours, and the manufacturing cost was maybe 50% of ours. So they had very good economic reasons for going, at least initially, the first ones, and then the rest followed them a bit like lemmings. But since then, the Chinese wages for the last 20 years have gone up 10 to 15% per year. And as a result, they've gone to the point where their wages are maybe a third or a fourth of ours. Now that manufacturing cost gets up to be 70% of ours. And now when the company looks at the other costs, what we call the total cost of ownership, when they calculate the duty and the freight, and the carrying cost of inventory, and the intellectual property risk, and the risk of stocking out, you know, not having product, which we're seeing on the shelves today. When they put all those factors in, total of 29 factors that our software calculates for them, then they see that a portion of the work, we'd say 20 to 30%, a portion of what they had offshored, they would be more profitable if they reshored.
You talk about a lack of an industrial policy in some of your materials. In fact, a deindustrialization policy. Explain what that means. And you sounded a bit hopeful about the Biden administration. So I would like you to take a little time to unpack what's happened in the recent period. Under Donald Trump, he was talking aggressively about trade, but he did put on tariffs. And I'm just wondering overall what you think a good industrial policy looks like, and put it in the context of the last two administrations.
Yeah, so a good policy would be a policy that enables industry as a whole to flourish in the United States. So instead of having industry like manufacturing, employment have shrunk from 27% down to about 9% of U.S. Total employment, whereas in Germany it's, say, 20% because they do have a good industrial policy. So instead of having shrunk so much, to recover significantly. So our goal would be to eliminate the trade deficit, adding 5 million manufacturing jobs. And the reason companies went offshore was price. And if you're going to bring the work back, if companies are going to see it's in their interest to bring the work back, they have to be able to have a price, you know, a manufacturing cost here that's competitive, that's let's say within 20% of the Chinese price or 10% of the German price. And so the way to do that is to have a skilled workforce that's as good as the Germans, where 60% of the high school kids go into apprenticeships. They get really smart kids, really well trained. So first choice is always skilled workforce. Second choice, get the dollar down by 20 or 30%. Almost all the other countries, one way or the other, managed to do that. Third would be to not raise the corporate income tax, because companies make their plant siting decisions based on the after-tax return on investment. So if you raise the tax, the U.S. doesn't look as good. Finally, maybe most controversial, would be to have a value-added tax. When other companies in other countries export, their country gives them a 15% credit on the value of the export. And when we ship things to those countries, our product gets a 15% tax, whereas we don't do either of those things. So we've made our products both at home less competitive against imports, and when we export, less competitive against anybody else in that other market. So to me, those are the four key elements. If we do those things, companies will see that the profitability of producing in the U.S. will go up. They'll shift more work back here. They'll hire more people. They'll train them better. They'll automate. They'll flourish here in the United States. If we don't do that, then it will not happen.
Why do we not hear anything about the value-added tax? I mean, we've all read about it as a European standard, but we don't hear any conversation in Congress about that, do we?
Well, back in 2016, 2017, we heard about a BAT, B-A-T, a border adjustment tax, which is functionally the same thing from an export and import perspective, put up by Brady, who was leading that tax effort by the Republicans. And it was shot down, as it has always been shot down, because the Republicans hate all taxes, and it's been proven very easy around the world to raise the value-added tax. It goes from 10 to 11 to 12, pretty soon it's 15, and eventually it'll get to 20%. It's been very easy to do that. And the Democrats specifically don't like a value-added tax because it raises the price of goods, and since goods are a higher percentage of the income of lower income groups, therefore the impact is higher on those groups. The solution is, if I were implementing it, I would eliminate all sales taxes, city, state, county sales taxes, and which average 8, 9, 10%. So two-thirds of the impact would be eliminated that way. And sales taxes are just a horrible bureaucratic mess trying to pay for a company to pay. So I'd get rid of the sales tax, and I'd use the remainder of the income to either fund Social Security, so that people could believe they'd actually get the Social Security that they've been promised instead of running out of money, or to even cut the actual Social Security tax rate paid by the worker so that that all income groups, and especially lower income groups, would get a significant benefit from it. So there's ways to rearrange the chess pieces so that it should be enough to make the Democrats happy, and I think the Republicans could be made happy too, but it's a very hard argument to get started.
And when I think about it, I mean, why does it feel like a tariff to me?
Because it's if a $100 product of any kind is being imported into the country, the importer has to pay 15%.
Right.
Typically, so it's a tariff or a duty. It feels just like a duty, which typically for the U.S. averages maybe 3 or 4%. So this would significantly raise the price, the domestic price of the imported product, make a U.S. car, U.S. made car, relatively more competitive in comparison to an imported car.
Now, Donald Trump and the tariffs in various industries against various countries, how effective or ineffective did you see that as being, and how do you look at tariffs in general?
The mistake that Trump made was that he was very chaotic or incomplete or inconsistent with his tariffs. So he applied them to certain products from certain countries for unknown periods of time and at changing rates. And therefore, businesses had no way of knowing what was going to happen. They had this business uncertainty to which I referred. And so, for example, by applying tariffs to steel, he significantly raised the price of steel in the United States. Now, that was good for the steel makers. They got to sell more and make a lot more money. But for the user of steel, making fittings or fasteners or anything out of steel, now their cost of steel is 10, 20, 30% higher than the Chinese or German company making an equivalent product. So where you have helped jobs at steel mills, and that's wonderful, you've hurt jobs at the consumers of steel. So the right solution, if you want to use tariffs as part of industrial policy, is something like the value-added tax that applies the tax uniformly across both the steel and the product made out of steel that's being imported. So now you have not disadvantaged one segment of U.S. industry relative to the rest of U.S. industry. I think tariffs can be, value-added tax specifically, very uniform, not all these 500 different categories with different rates and craziness, but 15% across the board value-added tax, I would be entirely in favor of. I see more and more mentions of it in the media. Economists are starting to recognize that it is finally the right solution, but it's still probably decades away.
Harry Moser is with us, the president of Reshoring Initiative. One of the other things that you point to in some of your materials is the high healthcare costs paid by employers. That would seem to disadvantage us in many countries where, in fact, they have a universal healthcare that is government provided, and yet now we lay that at the doorstep of employers, and that adds a lot of costs, as we know. So how much would you be arguing as part of the Reshoring Initiative for healthcare costs to be alleviated from that of the burdens put on employers?
Yeah, I'd be very much in favor of taking it away from the employer. One way to do that would be to make it a taxable benefit. You're taxed on your salary, you're taxed on whatever bonus, but you're not taxed on your medical insurance. So if it was taxable, then people would probably be more willing to shift it away from the employer. And if you did so, there's really two things that have to be done. One is to reduce the overall cost of medical care in the U.S. We spend something like 17% of our GDP on it. Germany does at least as good a job and spends maybe 10%, and some countries go 8% and do a good job. So there's no question we spend 50% to 100% more on medical care overall. And if you keep the cost that high, somebody's going to pay for it. It's either going to be paid by the company or by the worker or by the taxpayer, which finally is the worker. So first you want to cut the overall cost of medical care. I'm very much in favor of forcing the pharmaceutical industry to take U.S. pharmaceutical prices to the average of the 10 highest wage other countries like Germany, France, Italy, and so on. So it's an overall first cut the cost, and then second, shift it so that the realistically probably have people pay it themselves, which would get their attention as to how much it really costs, or tax us all a little more. Use that value added tax we talked about to pay for the healthcare.
Why is it that there are many economists who don't have the same concern that you point out, and others do, of course, to trade deficits? They say, well, you know, let the Chinese make these lower end goods. Of course, now when we see Taiwan really almost controlling all the chip making, and we're trying to bring that back, and I think you're saying in your initiative that, in fact, some of that is coming back here. But the whole idea that maybe some things are better made elsewhere, so that we can devote more of our activity to high-end production, to the knowledge-based economy. How do you respond to that?
Clearly, you need a certain minimum amount of manufacturing in the country, and I think we've gone below that. I've been in sort of debates with people, and I'll say, how low can it go? And they say, let it go to zero. I don't care. People can do something else. People can write software or do something. And for me, There's clearly a minimum, which is debatable, at that minimum, you have enough to support defense. You take advantage of the higher multiplier effect that manufacturing brings than almost any other activity in the country. Most of the R&D is done by manufacturing. The patents are issued to manufacturing companies. If you talk about some companies like Apple, designing whatever here, but manufactured there. But that works for Apple because they're Apple. They're so rich and so big. But for most companies, if you design it here and somebody makes it there, especially China, India, somewhere, eventually the communication falls down, and you don't have engineering and manufacturing working together to optimize the product and optimize the process for making the product. Eventually, you lose what Pisano and Xi at Harvard Business School call the industrial commons. You lose that knowledge base, which is essential for moving forward. So I'm convinced, you know, for those reasons and dozen others, taxes. If we had those 5 million people I'm talking about working in well-paid manufacturing jobs and creating multiplier effect jobs all around them, much more taxes being paid, much less welfare being paid out, and therefore more solid local and federal budgets. So just a broad variety of reasons that you can't just do services. If you just do services and write software for each other, we're not a we will no longer be a highly developed, advanced economy, and certainly will not be the sort of the geopolitical force that we are. Are we willing to decline to become what Britain has become, or even lower than that, even weaker than that? Well, that's a decision citizens have to make.
Are you concerned? We've all read about China. And a lot of the medicines that now are coming out of China, not only are we dependent upon them for various of these medicines that we don't make any longer in the U.S., but the quality control is another huge issue. And then I think you raised the issue of our defense products. I know one of our senators, Chris Murphy, has always been talking about making certain that the preponderance of that which goes into our defense and armament is made in the U.S. Have we given up too much of that already?
Now, let's start with the defense. Every year or two, the Defense Department puts out a fairly thick report describing the products and components, even materials, that they can source in the U.S. and those they cannot source here, and that they have to go to our allies or even to our adversaries for. And the list gets longer and longer all the time as the U.S. manufacturing base hollows out. And therefore, they're like rare earth minerals, absolutely essential. I can't remember, 400 pounds per F-35, and they go on to destroyers and stealth this and that and into the electronics. So lots of things like that that we're very heavily dependent on our adversaries or potential adversaries. So defense, I share completely, Sherry's concern completely. In medical, there's been reports, repeated reports that well established that we're 95% dependent on China, I think, for penicillin and for the active ingredients that go into other antibiotics. So if they stop shipping us in a week or a month or something, people would be dying here because you couldn't get those things, because you can't replace that quickly. That's a year or 2 years or something to replace those things. So I think the president is taking some steps on that. I support him in doing so. But at the bottom line, when you look at what the president's doing for chips, for all these other things, I see it as applying Band-Aids. You've got someone who's sort of bleeding to death, and they're applying Band-Aids or tourniquets. And like bringing the chips back is because we haven't been competitive, and therefore the chip factories have not been made here. And my concern is that we're going to spend tens of billions, build the chip factories, have to do it, I agree, but then our chips are going to be more expensive because our wage rates are higher here. And then we're going to get to a condition where we're making lots of chips, but we're still not assembling the infotainment systems for cars or the servers or the laptops. And therefore, we're going to have to sell those chips, our high-priced chips, to China to assemble those products. So we're still going to be dependent on China for our economy. So therefore, I say the government should have the industrial policy get costs down here relative to offshore, not by cutting wages, but by changing the dollar, changing the workforce, et cetera. And then the assembly of all those products will come back, or many of them will come back, which will then, and then our chip foundries will flourish.
Why is it that we protect, seemingly pretty aggressively of late, the strong dollar concept?
It's the strong dollar keeps inflation down. If we did what I wanted and the dollar were devalued by 20%, you would see probably over a couple of years as things adjusted, you'd probably see a 4 or 5% rise in the cost of living. And politicians that allow a significant rise in the cost of living don't get reelected. So they're afraid of biting the bullet, taking that step. The dollar is seen as the exorbitant privilege or something like that of the United States, because it's the reserve currency. Mm-hmm. And if you cut the value of the dollar, you're jeopardizing that advantage. But the euro is not the reserve currency of the world, and Germany has lower interest rates than we do, and benefits from the euro being relatively low makes them competitive. So in principle, if people believed the dollar was going to come down, interest rates would go up, which would make it harder to justify investment in automation. I mean, there's arguments on both sides, but to me, the overwhelming answer is to get it down. You don't cut it 20% today, but you inch it down, 2% a year for 10 years, something like that.
Do we really have an industrial policy? By that, I mean, I see industrial policies to some extent in individual states where they're trying to lure someone from state to state. And, of course, they have these entourages. I know my state of Connecticut, which used to be a manufacturing center, and they'll send a delegation overseas. I mean, do we really have a national industrial policy?
But we don't have a policy, as I said, because we have the actions that we've taken over the last 10 or 20, 30 years have been to deindustrialize, not have this emphasize sort of liberal arts university education instead of apprenticeships, have the corporate tax rate the highest in the world, not have a value added tax, all these have the lowest regular duties compared to other countries. So we've done all the things that would tend to hurt industry, and yet there are some signs of hope. There's a part of the Commerce Department called Select USA, focuses on bringing foreign direct investment in. That's a policy. The MEPs, Manufacturing Extension Policy Partnerships, you have a good one in Connecticut, that work with companies to, especially small to medium-sized companies, to be more productive and profitable. And some of those have also worked with us to enable reshoring in their state. So we've worked with the Polaris, which is the MEP in Rhode Island right next door, and we work with New York State on that. So we'd love to work with Connecticut to do it. So, for example, we have a policy that the states can implement, or a program in which we can identify the supply chain gaps, the product categories where the U.S. is not self-sufficient. We can identify those products, imagine a list of 500 of them, and then narrow it down to the ones where that are significantly imported into the state or the region, and where your biggest companies import a lot of them. And then we would have the state go to the foreign suppliers that are shipping the product in to convince one of them to put a factory in the state to meet that demand. So we have methodologies like that to help states develop their industrial policy.
You, of course, we started this conversation talking about the surge of 38% in reshoring. Where would you imagine we could see that over the coming years? I know a lot of community colleges have advanced manufacturing programs. We're seeing where a lot of young men, I don't know, Harry, if this is a trend that you've caught up to, I'm sure it is, but they're not going on to college. So there is an available workforce, particularly of men, who are choosing not to go to college for one reason or another. In combination, is the skilled workforce piece of all of this key and central, aside from the other policy directives that you have outlined very nicely today? How important is that, and do you see enough initiatives on that front?
The skilled workforce is the number one priority. Because if you don't have enough of it, you can't produce the increased quantity of goods. And if you don't have a good enough quality of it, you don't get competitive enough to get your costs down and your delivery down, improved, so that you can earn the business. So skilled workforce is absolutely essential. It's also, at the moment, it's like a ceiling. We'd like to bring back 400,000 manufacturing jobs a year. But at the moment, we have openings for 900,000 manufacturing jobs already, projected to go to 2 million in 5 years, and that's without a surge in reshoring. So So we'd say that the cap on reshoring is maybe 300,000 a year. If we go beyond that, the manufacturing economy gets too hot, it can't survive, and so we need those high schools and community colleges to flourish and bring in more students. We need the companies to start or restart apprenticeship programs, and between them to train an extra, 50,000, 100,000 skilled workers a year that would enable those factories to be built and manned here in the United States.
Since we deal with trends, in closing, if we were having this conversation a few years down the road, what do you imagine is possible, given all the factors that you see, given, this administration, we don't know how long they will be in, and their direction. What do you see ahead for reshoring?
My best guess is that the trend will... For a couple of years, I'd be delighted if we could run along at 250,000 jobs announced per year, And part of the benefit of bringing them in, part of the benefit of your message that you're taking out today and of the media covering reshoring is that the student, the guidance counselor, the parents can say, huh, manufacturing is coming back. It's not going away anymore. And the guidance counselor can tell Susie, yes, Susie, you want to become a toolmaker? Become a toolmaker. Once again, that's a great career. And so we need a couple more years of the trend to be apparent and for people to see that the skilled, what I call professions, can be a much better economic choice than a non-technical university degree. And if we have those 2, 3, 4 years of that, of good $300,000 a year and changing culture, then I'd like to see us go to $400,000 a year, $500,000. But that's we got a big jump.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I've got to tell you, I used to do a program once a month on radio called Manufacturing Matters, and I had a couple of guys who would proselytize the same message and say, look, manufacturing isn't what you remember from the sweatshops of the past and some of the difficult, conditions. There's clean and advanced manufacturing that's going on today, and it's a great career. It really is. So, again, if we can help to get that message out to some young person, man or woman, looking to find their way, Harry, there are a lot of kids a little bit lost in our culture today, and I think manufacturing might be the answer. Harry Moser, president of the Reshoring Initiative, bringing manufacturing back home. Harry, if somebody wants to stay up with all that you're doing, how can they do that?
Well, the website is reshorenow.org. I am harry.moser at reshorenow.org. There's a huge amount of information on the website, and if somebody has, if they can sign up for our 6 times per year e-newsletter, so they won't be inundated. If someone has a reshoring opportunity, a company that itself would like to source more here, or a smaller company that would like to sell more here, getting their customers to buy their product instead of imports, we have that all on the website, or they email me. My job is to get these 5 million jobs back, and I need the help of everybody in the country. And I'll help all of you do it.
Well, it's a big job, but certainly an important one. Harry Moser, thank you so much for being with us today. Very interesting conversation on America Trends. Thanks again.
Thanks, Larry.